and welcome to The Wire, Community and Indigenous Radio's national independent current affairs program. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. Today, 13 million Afghanis are starving as the impacts of COVID, drought and war take their toll. As the world gathers to take serious action on climate, will Australia step up? The next phase of a national anti-violence campaign is teaching young people to call out disrespect. And Australia's Journalists Union will part ways with the Australian Press Council amid concerns the regulator isn't keeping up with changes in the industry. Stay with us for the next half hour. Joining me from the newsroom is Soph Landau. Hi, Soph.
Hi, Sarah. The total number of COVID-19 cases reported in Australia is 29,578. There have been 25,486 recovered cases and a total of 910 deaths. Worldwide, 141 million COVID-19 cases have been reported, 80.4 million recovered cases and just over 3 million deaths.
And there have been new COVID cases in South Australia.
Yes, South Australia has recorded 9 new COVID-19 cases, all of whom are returned travellers quarantining in Medi hotels. Health authorities said the new cases bring the total number of active cases in the state to 30, the highest since the Parafield cluster in November when the state was forced into lockdown.
In other news, Western Australian Premier Mark McGowan will ask the Commonwealth to temporarily ban travellers from India following a hotel quarantine outbreak in the state.
That's right. India is currently facing a severe third wave of COVID-19, and Premier Mark McGowan wants the federal government to place a temporary ban on travellers from India. However, members of the Indian community want Australia to continue accepting arrivals from India on compassionate grounds, even if the travel ban is adopted. Mr. McGowan will raise the proposed ban with the National Cabinet, saying in the past month alone, 40% of cases in WA quarantine hotels had recently been in India. That's up from 11% in the previous month. But New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian says it's not appropriate to distinguish one nation over others. India has become the new global epicentre of coronavirus, averaging almost 250,000 new cases each day.
Moving on, Indonesia's Navy is searching for a missing submarine.
Yes, a submarine went missing north of the resort island of Bali with 53 people on board. The KRA Nanggala 402 was participating in a training exercise when it missed a scheduled reporting call. The vessel is believed to have disappeared in waters about 95 kilometres north of Bali. The Indonesian Navy have deployed scores of ships to search the area, including a hydrographic survey ship, and have asked for help from Singapore and Australia, which have submarine rescue vessels.
To the United States now, where a federal investigation has been launched into policing practices in the city of Minneapolis.
That's right. The investigation has been launched a day after one of its former officers was convicted of the murder of George Floyd. Attorney General Merrick Garland says the Justice Department will look at whether there has been a pattern of unconstitutional or unlawful policing. It follows national outrage over the killing of Mr. Floyd by Derek Chauvin. The former officer was found guilty of 2 counts of murder and 1 count of manslaughter on Tuesday. Chauvin was filmed kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest in May 2020. Mr. Floyd, an unarmed African-American, was pronounced dead an hour later. His death sparked protests across the US and worldwide and calls for police reform.
And a bomb explosion at a luxury hotel in the Pakistani city of Quetta has killed at least 4 people and wounded 12.
Yes, the Chinese ambassador to Pakistan is suspected to have been the target of an attack in the car park of the Serena Hotel, according to correspondents. Ambassador Nong Rong is understood to be in Quetta, the capital of Balochistan province near the Afghan border, but was not present at the scene at the time. The Pakistani Taliban have claimed the attack without giving details.
And finally, the Morrison government has used its sweeping new foreign veto laws to tear up Victoria's Belt and Road agreements with China.
Yes, the federal government introduced new laws last year, allowing it to review and cancel a range of international agreements struck by state and territories, councils and universities. Foreign Minister Maurice Payne has cancelled two deals between Victoria and China under the new laws, in what the Chinese embassy has denounced as another unreasonable and provocative move. Minister Payne said she would cancel those two deals, along with two older agreements between the Victorian government and Iranian and Syrian entities, because they were inconsistent with Australia's foreign policy or adverse to our foreign relations. But a spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Canberra said the move showed the Australian government had no sincerity in improving China-Australia relations.
Thanks, Soph.
Thanks, Sarah.
Australia will join the US tomorrow at the Leaders' Summit on Climate to discuss an international approach to combating climate change. The two-day meeting, hosted by US President Joe Biden, will comprise 40 world leaders, including Scott Morrison, with heavily increasing climate action on the agenda. The Global Summit has the potential to create a united effort against climate change, but with resistance within the Morrison government, experts are unsure whether Australia will step up to Biden's challenge. Dr. Elizabeth Bolton has practiced teaching and performed extensive research into climate and environmental change at the Australian National University. She told The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg the summit could herald a new united approach to the problem.
It's massively important, and I think Biden amalgamating all of these international nations to get together to have a discussion about this, to me, it's the potential of a new start in how internationally nations approach this problem, which is that, you know, cooperation is the answer, because it's so complex and there's so many technological and R&D opportunities that it has to be progressed together, and you do need those big engines of industry and R&D at the table. So I think, you know, it's a really, really vital conversation.
How do you think Scott Morrison will be received at the summit, considering his past actions or lack thereof on climate change?
Well, I think it's already in the pre-comments that are already being leaked, indicating that pressure is clearly being put on. They already called out the paucity of offering, you know, some simple technical solutions. Biden has said it can't just be technology. We need, intent and a whole range of a suite of policies and supporting legislation. And, you know, it needs to be a strategic approach. So I think the US have already called them out and they're applying the pressure.
What sort of agreements and targets are expected to come from this meeting?
Honestly, what the main thing is that whatever the particular technical target is that the main objective is to create a sense of cooperation and urgency among the international community and like a coalition and a partnership against this problem. And I think to me, that idea of it shaping the narrative and becoming a major international relations issue, that's a big outcome in itself.
What is your opinion on Scott Morrison's climate policy and approach to sustainability up until this point?
Clearly Australia's been caught wrong-footed, and it's a little bit embarrassing, because although, you know, the fossil fuel lobby was able to, you know, strongly influence Australia's policy, what we've seen is that we're small fry when it comes to global trends. It's been a little bit diluted because they thought we could dominate the space in our little backyard, but we've not paid heed to the larger gear changes that are happening globally in the climate, but also in the attitudes and policy and so forth. So we're behind the eight ball now, and, you know, we are in a bit of, I think it's really in a bit of a precarious situation, because we have a lot of those key decision makers at the moment are to have strong links with the fossil fuel industry. They've sort of got your back against the wall in a way, the spotlight's in their face and we're exposed, essentially.
Morrison has rejected the calls from city-dwelling Australians for stronger climate reform by saying, we will not achieve net zero in cafes, dinner parties and wine bars of our inner cities. What is your impression of this statement?
It's just a nothing statement. I think it's sort of pandering to the divisions in society, when we're in fact trying to amplify division, and the idea that we have separate Australias and things like that, where in fact this is an issue that goes across our community. And, you know, it's a petty little small-minded comment in my view, because it is the time for us to have an Australia-wide approach. And frankly, the task ahead of us is so immense. We don't have time for division. It's time to unify and work together, and I just don't think it's not helpful.
Do you believe that involvement in this summit could steer Australia towards some more genuine, thorough policy and action on climate change?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, you know, we just follow America, and in this situation where America are, recalibrating towards strong climate action, that's a good thing. But I think the ultimate thing is that Australia will probably do what it's always done, which is follow America.
Dr. Elizabeth Bolton from the Australian National University speaking to The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg. In Afghanistan, 13 million people are facing food shortages as the combined factors of drought, COVID-19 and ongoing conflict take their toll. Nessafor Mgendi is the International Delegation for Afghanistan with the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent. He has been in the country for the past 3 months and working in the region for many years. Nessafor spoke to me about why the Afghani people are so vulnerable.
Afghanistan is one of the most fragile contexts in the world in a combination of factors. As you know, many years of conflict. Then we had COVID-19. We've had socioeconomic impacts of that. But also you have a lot of people moving across borders, those who left the country and are returning. And then recently the drought situation. So there are a lot of underlying issues, vulnerabilities in this country. And of course, there's ever-present risk of disasters.
The current drought, particularly in Afghanistan, has hit hard. What are the effects that you've been seeing there?
Drought conditions are worsening. Right now we have around 16 provinces of the country, 34 provinces, which where drought conditions have worsened. And that's also a result of lack of rain, but also in the winter there was lesser snowfall, and then that of course resulted in quicker snow melt. And the impact is that the food availability is constrained. The main issue at the moment is making sure that people have food, at least, and water. Of course, because of COVID-19 and the socioeconomic impacts, while markets are functioning, the prices of food in the markets have increased, and therefore one way to address is to make sure that people have money to make sure they can buy the food, which is now most costly and less available, especially in their own farms.
I would imagine also that there's been economic hardship for those who are growing crops that without water or stability of weather, that that would also undermine an ability to make money.
Absolutely. Those who rely on irrigation, those are not as impacted as the rain-fed agriculture. And right now, the planting season or the sowing season is coming now, but the conditions are not right to plant because there's no moisture on the ground. And actually, the worst impacts will be experienced months from now because there are projections like wheat, which is a key crop here. Production of wheat will be reduced by around 16 to 27%. So we will be seeing the effects in the coming months.
How are they making ends meet?
In addition to the drought and the COVID-19, there have been decades of conflict. So the situation has not always been busy for them. They try their best to get along, and they've been doing remarkable things under difficult circumstances, which would not happen in your country and mine. It would be very difficult. So I think the best way at this point really is to make sure that we lessen what we call negative coping mechanisms, which means people should not sell their assets in order to buy food, or people should not get more into debt in order to afford food. And that is what many are doing now. In fact, a study done recently shows that many of them are highly indebted, and it will be years before they can recover that. So it means that their coping mechanisms have been affected. Naturally, because they just want to get food on the table. So that's the immediate need. But looking ahead, we will need to work with them and also inform them on how they can adjust the way of living, because this is going to be a reality as a result of climate change. So they need to start planting drought-resistant crop, for example.
What resources and support are available to them?
The authorities, ourselves, the Red Cross, Red Crescent, the United Nations agencies and other charity organizations are really doing their best to get at least the essentials to the ground to make sure these people can get at least the food and water to make sure they can move ahead in these conditions, especially because of COVID-19, the socioeconomic impacts are massive. Even before this, they've always been actually relying on humanitarian assistance for many years because of all these multi-layered vulnerabilities are still there.
How can people outside of Afghanistan help or assist in this situation?
Everyone in any part of the world can make an impact. by contributing to their favorite charity. So it could be the local Red Cross, it could be any other charity. Many of them have presence in Afghanistan, and whatever assistance is given, I can assure that it will get to the people, because the needs are massive and you have very many humanitarian organizations working under difficult circumstances. And the best way is everybody in Australia, in any part of the world, by contributing however small, that will make an impact. I'll give an example. If it's $10, that will feed a family. So there's no amount which is small to make an impact.
Nessafor Magendi, the International Delegation for Afghanistan with the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent. If you'd like to help with their outreach in Afghanistan or around the world, we'll put a link to more info on the Wire's website. Australia's Journalist Union, the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, or MEAA, represents over 5,000 journalists across the media industry. The organisation this week announced it will leave the Australian Press Council in 2025, saying the media regulator is no longer fit for purpose. Marcus Strom is the federal president of MEAA Media. He told The Wire's Michelle Stevenson about why the organisation has made the decision to leave.
We've had problems with the operation of the Press Council for a number of years that we've raised with them. One of our problems is the lack of transparency on who pays what to the Press Council. This is unknown. There's a question of governance. There's also, we feel that the Press Council hasn't kept up with community standards around a number of adjudications, particularly to do with some cartoons, assessment of what is of an anti-vaxxer, inconsistencies in decisions. And also, more broadly, the fact that there are about 14 different places that the public can go to complain about different ethical and other problems with the media, it's a problem. There should just be one place. And the media has converged. Print and digital are now converged in single platforms. Yet we still have a division dating from last century between print and broadcast governance. And we just feel that the Press Council hasn't even tried to keep up with this. So by leaving, we are hoping this will spark a debate about the need for a serious and modern and credible regulatory system for the media.
How will this decision affect your members?
In terms of day-to-day, it won't affect them at all, because our members who are at publications and outlets governed by the Press Council, they are still governed by the Press Council. So it's kind of an oddity that we are even members, given that we aren't publishers. This is a self-regulatory body of publishers. We have historically been members of it to support robust self-regulation of the media. More than half, or close to half, our members aren't even governed by what happens at the Press Council. We want to see a single regulatory body that covers the entire media so that the public has one place to go and we can then rebuild trust in the media.
The Australian Press Council say that they are disappointed with your decision and they don't agree with all the observations you made in your media release. What do you think of this response?
Their response shows that they agree with some of our criticisms, and we're having a pretty productive discussion with them at the moment. We'll be members of the Press Council the next 4 years. So we want to use that time to really push much more vigorously the need for a much more robust regulatory system for the media.
Do you think there's any potential for the Press Council to simply catch up with the changes that have been happening, or do you think there does need to be an entirely new regulatory body for the media landscape?
So I think that's an open question. I think we'd probably need a new body of some sort that would absorb the Press Council, some of the functions of ACMA, and then we could campaign to recruit publications back into the fold.
In your press release, you mentioned the MEAA Code of Ethics. What role do you think this will play in the industry going forward?
Our Code of Ethics is one of the oldest codes of its type in the world. We have our own internal governance and regulation of that, where if people feel that our members have breached that code, they can make a complaint and we can review that complaint. It's not just an aspirational document. Our Code of Ethics is at the heart of Australian journalism. It is referenced in a lot of publications. It's recognised by media academics, by publishers, as really one of the highest forms of governance for ethics. At the moment, we are negotiating enterprise agreements with News Corp and with The Guardian, and trying to get into our agreements there a recognition that our Code of Ethics is an industrial matter, not just a issue of ethics, that our members shouldn't be and can't be directed to perform unethical journalism. And we will continue to fight for that document, which we take very seriously.
Marcus Strom, Federal President of MEAA Media, speaking with The Wire's Michelle Stevenson. If you see disrespect, unmute yourself. That's the message driving the latest $18 million phase of the Australian government's Stop It at the Start campaign, targeting violence against women and girls. Online resources and tools are encouraging us to start conversations about respect and challenge harmful attitudes and behaviours. Christy Masella is a proud Dhirubhoo woman, mother of two daughters, CEO of the Aboriginal Employment Service and Stop It at the Start campaign supporter. She tells The Wire's Soph Landau more about the campaign and her experience in teaching young people respect.
Stop! I said stop!
He needs to stop doing that.
I said stop it!
Bob is like, sir.
The Stop It at the Start campaign is about calling out disrespect to women and girls. It's about empowering people to have conversations, empowering us with words on how to have those conversations, and it's about educating everybody to kind of reflect on what's happening in our own families and communities, about what disrespect looks like, the different ways disrespect is actually harming our families and communities, and actually taking some action to make sure, you know, we're going to have stronger, healthier communities where disrespect is not part of our story.
He does this all the time. He just misses me.
This most recent phase of the campaign centres around if you see disrespect, unmute yourself. Could you tell us what that means to you?
Me being part of this campaign, it's been a little bit of a self-reflection and looking back on my own journey. You know, I'm a 46-year-old mum woman, and I guess it's good in a way that I feel empowered at my age to call out bad behaviour. But for much of my life, sadly, I haven't felt that empowerment and never had it. And for me, it's been having conversations with my own daughters about making sure they've got the strength or that it's normal to actually call out bad behaviour and that's okay to actually pull someone into line when they see things. I think for too long, many of us, men and women and different parts of communities, we haven't felt empowered to do that. So I want to make sure that my daughters from day dot feel empowered to speak up.
When my friend faced something quite disrespectful, I would say, and we went to a teacher about it, and the teacher kind of said, brushed it off and said, oh, don't worry about it, it was just a joke. You know, doesn't need to go any further, just leave it at that.
What do you think is the importance of providing adapted resources for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, different approaches for the community?
Well, you know, we've got our own stories. We've got different experiences to other communities, like other communities have different stories to us. We want to design our own strategies. Part of that empowerment for us to speak up and unmute ourselves must come from us being part of the design of those campaigns as well. We'll have different ways that disrespect is carried out, different things that have contributed to those types of behaviours. So it's really important that they're delivered and designed in a way that we can relate to, that speak to us and actually empower us to have the conversations in our own way.
And you would hope the kid who did something disrespectful actually understood what he did wrong?
Yeah.
And that the adult took you seriously and understood it as well?
100%. Yeah.
Okay.
How have your girls found having these conversations with you?
We've had some really great conversations, quite deep and heavy conversations too, but I've been really proud as a mum that my girls are a lot stronger, a lot more confident than I was at their age in having these conversations. And I've actually seen them call out disrespectful behaviour in a really direct, confident way, probably done in a slightly different way than what I would have done. Not concerned about possibly the consequence of
how someone may react, more focused on this is bad behaviour, and whether you receive it in a positive or a negative way is kind of irrelevant at this point. Someone needs to know that this is not okay. So I've been quite impressed by seeing my daughters actually take action, and I've actually learnt from them as a mother. You think, you know, as parents we're supposed to show our kids the way, but it's been a really great process for me as a mum to actually learn from my own daughters as well.
Christy Masella, CEO of the Aboriginal Employment Service and Stop It at the Start campaign supporter, speaking with The Wire's Soph Landau. That's it for The Wire today. This program is a team effort by 2SER Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and we are produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear us through your radio or on our podcast every weekday across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Today's show came from the studios of Radio Adelaide on Kaurna Lands. I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for joining us.
Jokes between you and me, I could shower this with meaning. Knowing is just make believe. It's worth more when you lose. It's too late when you choose. It's money, but you've gotta try. You take it for the fun, now you're coming undone. It takes so much and so little time. You're not even old as life arrived. You're falling by the passing sign. And in one moment, all the time, you're learning on the edge of your life. Do we call this fallacy? Doing what I do. Is this life in the backseat a mystery to you? It's hard breathing, even I would think this through. Hard breathing.